CliffCentral.com.
At Sibanye, we believe leaders are made, not born. We also believe we can create a sustainable legacy by helping to develop tomorrow's leaders today. We are proud of our partnership with the Leadership Platform and will continue to support leaders who are committed to growing our country. Sibanye, we are one. Visit us on sibanyegold.co.za.
This is our leader interview section of the Leadership Masterclass. We've got Athol Williams with us, executive turned poet and author of Pushing Boulders. In fact, he's here from Oxford. That sounds good, doesn't it, Athol?
It does sound good. Say that again.
He's here from Oxford, and he's really just in town to launch his book, Pushing Boulders. Fascinating, the parts that I've read so far, and he's certainly a Cape Town boykie, South African, but studying at Oxford at the moment, and tonight he launches his book here in Johannesburg. Athol, welcome.
Absolutely wonderful being here, Adrian, with you and with Louis. Great to be able to talk about leadership and some of the things I've been up to.
Yeah, we're very excited. And I've got Louis Groenewald with me as well. We're doing a pre-recording on a Friday afternoon for Monday's show, which will be the 10th of October. And we're sitting in a hotel room here. I'm excited for Athol, a man who's come a long way, and he's about to launch this book. Athol, am I saying it correctly when I say from high-flying executive to poet, because you did have very senior corporate positions for a long time, then you started your own strategy consulting business, but you've pretty much now become more full-time poet.
That's right, I was. I was a full-time executive, I was a partner at a global strategy consulting firm, I was the strategy director for a large financial services company, so you're a full-time corporate executive, and I often say my CV, when I looked at it in the past, the top part was the businessman, and the bottom in the general section was poet. And now I flipped it upside down. Now I am mainly a poet. It wasn't as stark a change of going from business and stopping that and starting being a poet. I've been writing poetry since my late teens, early 20s. But in recent years, poetry has become to play a far more greater role in my focus and where I've been focusing my energies.
And one can very easily underestimate what a poet means. The conversation we had earlier was that when you're a poet, you can actually discuss a lot of things. You can discuss politics, probably, depending on the genre, I guess, that your poems are playing.
Yeah, exactly. And mine particularly are, I write lyrical poems, so they're stories. There's a little drama in most of the poems, not very abstract. But they definitely focus on social and political issues.
But your book is also social, political issues, and personal. We'll look at that a little bit towards the end of the interview. Yeah. But before we go to the poet element, because I'm very fascinated by the step of actually shifting from poetry being just a hobby on the side, the bottom of your list, to being on the top of your list. I mean, that's a fascinating, brave step. Before we go there, what exactly, when we say from executive, you had senior positions, you had your own strategy consulting business, what did that entail? I mean, you drove what you wanted to drive, you spent what you wanted to spend, you had the high-flying life. Just tell us a little bit about that.
It was exactly that, and I love cars. So I, at one point, had six cars. I had a BMW 8 Series, BMW 6 Series, I had a Lamborghini, a Jaguar, a Rolls-Royce, and I had a convertible Mustang. And so it was bizarre because I had to rent garages all over the place. So literally, I was living the young bachelor life, enjoying cars. I had a library at home with 10,000 books, a library that I had custom built. And as part of making this change was actually to change my lifestyle entirely. Mm. And I think a lot of things came together of saying, well, this question around materialism began to challenge me quite a bit. I remember an incident of driving one of my cars in Cape Town and stopping at a traffic light and seeing these people living in shacks off to my side. And there was a moment where I thought, I really struggled to reconcile these two. I see absolutely nothing wrong with enjoying the fruits of your work and owning beautiful things. But for me personally, it questioned the role I was playing in society.
But I also want to say, as a poet at heart, I guess it was difficult for you to ignore those feelings, to ignore those emotions and that progress inside of you. You couldn't just ignore it.
It's exactly that. I fully believe that business plays obviously plays a vital role in society.
Yeah.
And as a business person, I always thought I was not only making money and developing products, but also playing a constructive role in society. I think what changed from business person to then poet was a different role I wanted to play in society. Because so part of this transition was me saying, I remain as committed to excellence as I was as a business person, but I want to play a different role. I want to play a role of going and having the conversations which I think we struggle to have. I want to have a role of inspiring people to live lives of excellence and to do amazing things.
I want to get there. That transition to me today is very important, because I know there's a lot of executives and business people out there who are asking questions about the quality of their lives, the stress, the intensity of it. Life is just different than it was 30, 50 years ago. Mm. So before we go there, though, where does the poet come from? You say you kind of started actively on the side doing it while you were a student?
Yeah.
In school, were you interested in poetry? Where does that come from?
It's a great, great question. I think where it started was, I started writing. I've kept a diary since the age of 15, and I'm writing diary daily.
Mm.
And so it started as me keeping a record. And it's amazing, you know, when I was 15 years old in 1985, was the time of the big uprising in South Africa. And I was, you know, in Mitchell's Plain in high school. And so I've got these amazing short records of things like, you know, Casper's at our school today, you know, school's burning, and, oh, I noticed this cute little girl, you know, who I really like. And so typical sort of 15-year-old boy with these range of interests, sport, cars, girls, and then capturing these things that were happening around the country in terms of the political upheaval. And so it started as just writing my thoughts in a diary. And I think it evolved eventually to trying to want to express it and share it with others.
But that already, Louis, is not normal for a teenage boy to have a diary. Louis?
No, it does manifest deep-rooted instincts that Ethel has. Mm. And it was starting to manifest. But I think it's manifested completely differently as the years go by. Artie, I'm very interested. You mentioned your interest in the poetry side. In our case, Ethel, for many years now, our quest has been to try and delve into the essences of good leadership, that part of everybody that enables them to move situations in a positive direction. Mm. Now, in your case, if I should define it, always the search for essences, that quality poetry is really the quest for refined, authentic refinements.
Mm.
Now, with your background, in the, let's say, the kind of traditional materialistic world as well, the values in that world,
mm.
you've undergone quite a dramatic change in your feelings regarding the ethics and basic. So therefore, your drive as a poet is a quest for the authentic refinements of principle. And that speaks to the inner person mm. of a person. And ultimately, what you said in our discussion beforehand is also that we're discovering more and more that the inner person matters the most in good leadership, or else they will bend down for fatigue and burnout mm. and things like that. We really appreciate the connection, our quest and your quest. The expression, the poetic expression, really is about arriving at those essences of what's really important.
I absolutely agree. I like that we've captured that, Louis, around the essence and the idea of authenticity.
Mm.
I think poetry gives us a language when our other languages fail. And I think often we struggle to communicate and connect with each other. And I see no difference between, you know, we say man and businessman or woman and businesswoman. Ultimately, it's still man and woman. And we want to connect. So I've often, so part of my journey has been, I've been intrigued as a business person with the following dichotomy. We have someone who's at home, and when you're at home, you care about human rights, you care about the environment, you care about what's happening in the country, and then you cross the road and go to your business, your office, and suddenly there, the behavior often appears to be, I don't care about what's happening to the environment, I don't care what's happening to human rights. So what happens? What happens when I cross this road? What, does something change within me? Is it the environment that changes? So why do I often behave in a very different way? Because when I meet with executives outside of the offices, they are just humans like you and I, yeah. worried about their children, you know, frail and vulnerable. And yet we behave in very different ways in these different roles. So this idea of role morality is very interesting for me. Because what's an honest business? What's an honest business person? Is that different to an honest person at home?
Mm. Very, very good. I mean, you raise a very good point. I guess that the word that rings in my mind is mask. have we become so used to having a mask on at work? We've seen this where you would interview the CEO of a major listed entity, and then this individual retires. And we have them in the studio again, and we have a conversation, and you see the beard suddenly, you see the relaxed, and you just see a whole different person. You think, why so different? We understand you have a title and you have a mantle that you're... But why so different? You know,
it's exactly.
If you were more relaxed as a CEO and not so tight and so formal, you probably would have done better.
Exactly. And this is the idea that we play these roles, and it's a mask. Now where did this come from? It's some sort of social norm around it that says, you know, this is how a business person should look and behave and talk. And I prefer saying, you know, let's be human. Let's really see each other for who we are. Let's not look past each other. Yeah. And continue that engagement around who we are. I think that changes every aspect of business. I think it changes, you know, how you deal with finances, how you deal with your customers, how you deal with your staff, because you're being real.
And very much about the trust between you and your staff and your stakeholders as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
They sense that you're being more authentic. It's amazing, though, when your people do that, how responsive people might be if you make mistakes, admit it.
Exactly.
Because they sense you're authentic.
Exactly.
You're not speaking a corporate language that you don't trust, or political speak, as our young guests on our show often speak. They're tired of this political speak.
Yeah.
It doesn't really touch the person inside.
Exactly.
We can come back to that. I just want to go one step back. Why the leap of taking poetry at the bottom of your list and just kind of doing it on the side a bit to putting it on the top? And why didn't you just continue your life successfully helping business leaders succeed with their strategies and their businesses and just continue writing poetry on the side? You said earlier you wanted to contribute differently to society, but is there more that happened with you? Is there more that triggered it inside of you? Because it's not easy in this world that teaches us materialism and success. The symbols of success are A, B, and C.
Yeah.
And you were now potentially threatening that by shifting your life so dramatically. I want to know more about that process. There are definitely people out there who are executives, leaders, who want to change. They want to do something differently. They feel the pace is too much. They've got to change, but they just won't.
Yeah. Adrian, I suspect to try answering this five different ways, and so I'll give you my first attempt at it, because it was never as simple and clean a change. You know, I was very challenged personally by the quote by Nelson Mandela that says, to be free is not merely to cast off your own chains. So to be free is not merely to cast off your own chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others. Right? The way I rephrased it was, until I've enhanced the freedom of others, I'm not free.
Okay.
Right? And I turned that upside down. And so there I was, in my mind, I grew up under apartheid. For the first 24 years of my life, I was apartheid. As a colored person, that had particular costs and burdens to me. I was now a very successful business person, and I felt I was free. You know, South Africa had changed. Socioeconomically, I could, I was free. I could live anywhere I wanted, anywhere I wanted. But if I didn't see everyone else around me as free, then I couldn't enjoy that freedom. And I think it's a choice you have to make. And I think a lot of people do go and say, well, now I'm free. You know, apartheid's gone. Let me kind of enjoy the fruits of our struggle. And I felt the struggle wasn't over, because for me, freedom was more than just political change or political freedom. There had to be something around socioeconomic freedom as well. So,
and not just economic, but social and philosophical, maybe.
It's exactly. Yeah. I think there's, you know, my view on this debate in South Africa around equality, I think it's got the wrong focus. I'd rather want equals in terms of dignity, right? I want equality in terms of relationship. Right now, we're focusing far too much on equality of how much you've got and how much I've got. I think that's part of it. Right? Because surely I can't live in a shack and you live in a mansion.
Need and property say, and so on.
It's
yeah.
Exactly. But if we're saying the moment you and I've got the same number of coins, are we equal, or do we stand as equal citizens? I think the focus needs to be far more on us standing as equal citizens, equal human beings, not on just material holdings.
Yeah, so what bears that out is, you know, we've interviewed hundreds of quality people around, and there's a pattern. Those people have really fought their way up. Based it on a basis of self-esteem. They built on that. In other words, the transformation was first personal and then outward as well. Whereas nowadays there is a tendency to rely on the entitlements of society, and that does impoverishes people. people in a very serious manner. Because if you rely on entitlements as such only, you don't grow.
You don't change.
And it's a blame syndrome. So what you're saying is the basis of your success in life really is a deep-rooted quest for honesty and for who you are, rather than who other people are. And only then can you really serve your society properly.
I think that's exactly right, Louis. I think you've got to have something to give, right? So as I fill up who I am, understand who I am, you know, can really explore who I am, only then can I begin to give to others constructively. And yet again, we have leaders who have come through the ranks in some way, unable to really understand who they are, what makes them tick. How then can we possibly expect them to inspire others to do great things?
Ethel, one of the patterns emerging all our conversations also is that top leaders have the ability to confront situations and to engage with people. Now, normally, if you build your brand purely on what you possess, you will avoid people. So people who have gone through the process of self-realization, they're not afraid to engage as well, because they don't rate people's dignity by their possessions, they're rated by their self-esteem and their potential and the respect for that, which is such a great principle. I think the poet in you really helps us bring that to the fore. The truth is, Ethel, that all people listening to this must realize that ultimately you must face yourself.
Yeah.
And you can't live a sham world. Ultimately, it's about who you really are and who you become, and then your close relation with that, to what extent you really can serve your community. And Nelson Mandela was a good example of that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, I mean, I'm pretty sure I've heard both you and Adrian say that, Louis. It's about self-leadership firstly, right? How do you, it's about how you manage your own life before you can begin to impact others. But just to touch on something you said, this idea that, I also want to make sure people understand, you know, my background. So I'm not this hippie poet, even though I look like a hippie these days. You know, I've got an engineering degree. I've got a master's in finance. I've got a master's in public policy. So highly analytical in my training and my abilities. But what I've done is I've tried and worked really hard on this ability to say, let me explore who I am, look beyond the analytical, beyond the brain, and find something else inside of me, which I think exists within all of us, that haven't been fanned enough, right? And there's this idea again of the masks. Adrian's point about masks. So I grew up kind of thinking as a business person, as a man, right? I don't read poetry. I don't reveal emotion. And I think we're all poorer for it.
Yeah, very good point. I want your views on leadership as well in a moment. But before we go anywhere, and you're also sharing at the moment as I listen carefully, because my question was that what have you discovered as you shifted your life to becoming a full-time poet in a way? And I guess keeping that going by consulting. So you have strong views on leadership. You work with top leaders. And I want to bring us there. Just before we run out of time, your book,
yes,
Moving Boulders. Why did you write it and what's the essence of it? It's a real South African story.
Yeah.
It's got interwoven into it the political issues and the social issues and the economic issues. But it's through your lens, which is a very fascinating lens and a simple one. I think anyone can read it. It's not just for, I don't know, black, white, executives. It really isn't. Motivation there, where was it? Tell us about this journey briefly.
So it was, the title's Pushing Boulders, and the subtitle is Oppressed to Inspired. And it's got a number of layers to it. So oppressed in the sense of, okay, under apartheid, oppressed. But I'm far more interested in having our minds that are oppressed to our minds being open and inspired. So the story, I wrote it over the last 2 years. My reason for writing it was twofold. The one was, I think it's important for us to tell our stories, no matter who we are. Granny living somewhere on a farm, or a young person living in the city, I think we must tell our stories, because that narrative helps us understand each other. And I think often in South Africa, the difficulty is we don't see each other, because we don't really know each other. And I think writing stories and poetry can help us begin to see each other.
We seem to know each other when we have our masks on in the working place.
That's exactly
the working ones. Then we go back home and we don't even mingle in many ways, especially across race. So we don't know each other.
Completely. And I like this idea of using a similar event and saying, well, here's Ethel's experience of it. And then here, Adrian, your experience of it. Right? So, the World Cup 1995. Write about how that felt. What did it mean to you? The second reason I wanted to write the book was, I believe that we have amazing possibilities opening to us in our lives. Amazing possibilities. I believe in the infinity of what humans can achieve. Yet everything around us is around containing and capping and limiting. Right? Don't do that. You can't do that. Don't try that. This fear of failure. And so I certainly wanted to use my example, not as the exemplary life of someone who's done that, but an example of a life of someone who's tried things. So I've failed a number of things. And you mentioned, I'm at Oxford right now. I've applied to Oxford 3 times, right? Twice I got denied, I got rejected. But I so believed that it was the right thing for me to do, I applied the third time. My poetry books, my very first poetry book I published in 2007, no publisher would publish it. In fact, I sent it for a manuscript evaluation by a poetry expert in South Africa. And he recommended that I just discard the manuscript. It was that bad. and I published it myself anyway. So for me, the message of self-belief and resilience and just possibility, right? If you believe in something you're doing, get on and do it.
And so I hear so many people say, gee, I tried that and it just didn't seem to work out. So I guess it's not meant to be. We must be. It's a very fine line, isn't it?
I agree.
Very fine line. Sometimes it is not meant to be.
Yeah.
And other times it's just resistance. It's
exactly.
Just a challenge. And therefore you can apply a third time and go to Oxford. I don't know that anyone ever really knows which it is.
I completely
agree.
Is
it not meant to be or is it resistance? But
I use just sort of pushing boulder. The sort of image is that there's a Greek mythology, Sisyphus, who's a king who's cursed, and his curse is he's going to push this boulder up a hill for eternity. So he pushes the boulder up the hill. He gets near the summit, and the boulder rolls all the way down again. Now, for me, that's a powerful image in terms of anything we do, because I think we focus on the skill to push the boulder and the strength to push the boulder. But what we fail is what to do when the boulder rolls all the way back down. Because then I think you've got to make a profound choice. Mm-hmm. Because the choice is to say, let me go all the way back down this hill again and redo what I just did. Reapply. Retry this new effort. You know, and for me, all the successful people I've looked at, that's their story. They failed 10 times.
So what you're saying, Ethel, is that the only real failure is to stop trying. It sounds like cliche, but it's so much true, because it's on the trying that real character is born.
It's exactly that.
You know, and the calluses come of life.
Because I think, and I've had that, when you stand on the top of the hill, the boulders roll all the way down, right? And there's a part of you that says, forget about it, this wasn't meant to be. Let me just kind of, you know, walk without having pushed this boulder. But I think that's when real character is built. When someone says, no, this is the right thing for me to do, my dream being fulfilled is on the other end of me pushing this boulder. I've got to go all the way back down again and push again.
Mm.
And I think that's when you really build amazing character.
Ethel, what occupies your time right now? When I look at your Facebook, for example, I often see you in front of kids.
Mm.
Often see you at schools. So what I know you also consult with your expertise over many years with top leaders on strategy in their businesses, in the financial services industry more so. Before we go there and talk about leadership, you seem to spend a lot of time in front of the next generation.
Mm. And that is, Adrian, this is part of me trying to, again, rethink the role I can play in society. And I think it's important for all of us to think about the role we can play in society. And one thing I noticed in some of our under-resourced communities was just simple thing like kids don't have brand new books. They've never owned a new book. The libraries aren't stocked. And so I set out to change that. But what I learned was it wasn't just about having a book. Because you can give a child a book that's actually destructive, because it reinforces gender stereotypes, it reinforces violent stereotypes. And I discovered that children actually lack some inspirational, motivational input into their lives. So for 2 or 3 years, we did this research, and then this was our revelation. And so I decided to use my poetry and my writing skill to then write books that I thought and the people I consulted thought were inspirational. So we wrote this whole series. I'm writing a series of books that Oaky is the character, is a little acorn that grows to be a big oak tree. To write constructive, in terms of literacy development books, but also inspirational stories for children that kind of transcend all the races and all genders. And so I want to inspire children. And I think we can inspire a child. So I know my one book's not going to change a child's life. But if you somehow inspire the child to be something greater than what they are, greater than how they see themselves, I think you're making a real difference in the country.
All right. Well done. I mean, that's remarkable. So it's not just about writing poetry books and putting them on the shelf, but there's a bigger story behind it. Your view on leadership. So you consult with leaders. You're a poet, so you look at things from different angles. You're a thinker, but you're also a strategist.
Mm.
And you also visit with leaders. And as you said earlier, fascinating. If the leader can't see you, then you sit in his or her car on the way to the airport,
exactly.
If it needs to be. we're concerned about the toxic leadership that we have. There's a lot of toxic, unauthentic leadership out there. And leaders are struggling. There's a lot of stress and strain. Your view, what are you finding out there as you engage top leaders? What's the pulse?
My sense is that there's fatigue. I sense a heaviness amongst the leaders that I engage with. A heaviness in that they are pressed with so many demands that they feel incapable of dealing with it. Incapable in terms of the scope of the demands, but also in terms of their development and their training. I'm talking about things, you know, there are macroeconomic, macro-political challenges, of course, but there are things around the changing demographic in society, the need for transformation, the concern about the political change in the country. And I think my sense is they're feeling a bit overwhelmed by the myriad of things they've got to manage in running their businesses.
Do you think they have answers? Do you think the answers are there? Do you think this world of just speeding up, isn't it? Mm. This incredible speed at which things are happening and the influx of information and the internet of things, you know. Yeah. We can just keep talking all day about how challenging that is. Do you think they're finding the answers? The models, how to deal with this crazy world?
I haven't seen many of the answers. I don't think the answers exist in clear ways. I think what I would want to advise CEOs to do is to develop the approach to finding the answer, not necessarily give them the answer. I think what Louis was saying...
The process that they might need to follow.
Exactly. It's exactly that. Louis was saying earlier that, you know, we've got a myriad of stakeholders now that executives could think about. In the old days, it was just shareholders. But now there are other important stakeholders to think about. Mm-hmm. I look at some multinational businesses who now care, got to deal with climate change issues. They've got to deal with human rights issues. And so there's this complexity of what they've got to deal with. And they don't know, not so much the answer, but how to deal with it.
So based on that, our discussion is example now. We believe that part of the answer, part of the process, is this kind of conversation where you have preferably somebody available on the podcast or direct, somebody who's walked the coals of life, and somebody also that has discussed, has studied the theory of things, of the inner self, etc. Then you have conversations regarding, and when you have a conversation continually, not just once in a blue moon, it should be a regular part of your leadership world, even at your home, etc. I think that's when behavior can start changing. So it's not just a theoretical study, it's when you put all things together and you talk about it and not afraid to confront it. Now, for instance, in this discussion, we discussed some very important issues that can have impact on anybody's life as well. And I feel at 75 years old, I am growing in the experience. We've also found somebody who thinks they've arrived is on a dangerous precipice.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's no such thing. Absolutely. What you are saying, you don't feel you have the answers, but you do believe you're getting closer to the process of honesty, of conversations around it, and that I love. It makes perfect sense to me. It's what we find out with our years of experience in this area.
Exactly. I think it's, you know, I've got a poem called One Finite Life. And it makes this, it's obvious, it's in its statement. It says, I've got one life and it's finite, right? There's no technology that's going to make me not die. I know I'm going to die. So let me accept that, right? Not deny it. The moment I accept it, I then say, now let me make these years count. Whether I'm a CEO or I'm a junior person, saying, how am I going to make these things count? How can I make my life count? What impact am I going to have? What's going to be important to me? And like you said earlier, this sounds like cliches, but it's, how can I make this life count? And what I decided as Athol Williams was to say, I'm going to try and do the impossible things. I'm going to try and do things that just seem ridiculous and stupid and mad. At 46, to go to Oxford and have classmates who are 23 years old, literally half my age, and say, why not? Why not me?
I love that. And I want you to give a final message to leaders. That's almost like a final message. And we're in a world where you have to push the boundaries and where impossible really seems possible like never before. What is your final message to leaders?
I think as a leader, go back to who you are. I think we know who we are. I think we know what makes us tick. I think we know what we'd love to do. And strip away these other things of the expectations. Remove those masks, as you used that image earlier. And saying, find out, but be clear on who you are and why not live that life, right? And that doesn't mean you change anything. It doesn't mean go and sell everything or change what you're doing. But be true to yourself. Because only I think when you're true to yourself can you then begin to be true to other people and be true to all the stakeholders you've got to serve.
Ethel Williams, thank you so much. Executive to poet, still working with top leaders, but your priority is poetry and making a difference in the world that way. Then your book, Pushing, let me just get it right, Pushing Boulders, Oppressed to Inspired. Excellent book, and it's going on the shelves. You're launching it in Gauteng tonight. This is Friday evening. So thank you for being our guest, and it's been wonderful. Keep up the good work, and I think you inspire us to go back to our roots and see who the heck am I, and how can I follow an authentic life rather than allow society to mold me or tell me where I need to go, and then act like I'm happy.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm
exactly.
making a difference. Thank you. Good luck with the book launch.
Thank you very much, Adrian. Thank you, Louis. Wonderful spending the time with you.
Louis, do you want to give a final comment?
Final comment is, Ethel, having the first time I met you, really, I just respond to that inner self I see in you, and that the seeking self, and the fact that you don't feel you've arrived, but you are arriving, even though it may take eternity longer. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
That was the interview with Ethel Williams, executive turned poet, fantastic, and get his book, author, the book Pushing Boulders, it's a good book. Just to end off our leadership masterclass then, a thought, let us grow authentic leaders, it's a Sibanye executive leadership thought, let us grow authentic leaders faster than we do toxic, egotistical bosses. And by the way, we've launched Leadership Activists. So if you have a toxic leader that you just think you can do nothing about, email me personally, adrian@leadershipplatform.com. Two P's in the middle. We'll try and help you with that. Do go read about this on our website. Next up, Business Masterclass with Richard Angus and Belinda Wagner in association with USB Ed. And it's all about customer lifetime value. CliffCentral.com.